is the Tom Hartman Program.
And greetings, my friends, patriots, lovers of democracy, truth, and justice, believers in peace, freedom, and the American way. Tom Hartman here with you. Wow, a lot of stuff to talk about today. Mike Huckabee just announced he's running for president. Is he calling for a maximum wage? We'll get into that. He says we don't need a minimum wage anyway. There is a serious attempt, it appears, on the part of the Republican Party to get Hillary Clinton to come out and say, oh, yeah, I'm in favor of this trade deal, so that the Republicans can then push it through Congress and then blame her. There are already some of the right-wing websites are already starting to call it Obama trade, and pretty soon they'll call it Clinton trade. And, of course, her husband passed or signed NAFTA and the GATT, which created the World Trade Organization. So we'll see where all this goes. But I wanted to start with something, just an observation about politics and human relationships, romantic relationships or interpersonal relationships on the one hand, and political relationships on the other hand, and how they might relate to each other, or how, you know, what are the parallels? Because a lot of us in 2008, when Barack Obama was running for president, basically fell in love with him. And a lot of people in the years since then have not only fallen out of love with him, but even gotten to the point of, like, you know, the circular firing squad. Nothing he can do is right or good enough, that sort of thing. I think Chris Hedges just published a piece basically bashing Bernie for joining the Democratic Party, for example. I mean, this is like the extreme example of it. So how does this happen? How do people fall in love, bond? And then on the backside, how do they break up? What is the cycle of relationships, and how does that apply to politics? Probably the woman who has done the best work on this is Diane Vaughan. She wrote a brilliant book called Uncoupling. And years ago, Louise used to coach couples. She used to be a relationship coach, and did a lot of work with this in people, and so I'm very familiar with it. So here's the process, okay, with individuals. When two people first start sparking, everything that they're looking for in the other person is always, how is that person just like me? Oh, she likes the same stuff I do. Oh, he likes the, he has the same opinions I do. Oh, you know, she, you know, like that. They find all the areas of identicalness, and they continually amplify those areas of identicalness until there's a relationship, right? And until, and at that point, that's really infatuation. It feels like love, and it can become love, and it's infatuation. And then the second stage, and again, this is like, you know, Barack Obama. I during 2008, I was saying he's the national Rorschach test. And I don't want to make this all about Obama, because we've got another election coming up, and Republicans go through this, and Democrats go through this, and this has to do with the base and everything else. But we were infatuated with him because we all saw in him what we wanted to see. Then the second stage of a relationship happens, and this is the getting to really know you, where the differences start becoming evident. Oh, you don't like that food, yeah, but I like that food. Oh, you don't like to go out, you know, for walks, but you'd rather sit on the couch, but I would rather go for, you know, or whatever it may be. I mean, people start, and of course, obviously, most of those differences are much more substantial than that. But as the differences become visible, typically one of two things happens. Either the infatuation cools down, and people just kind of part as friends, and hey, we had a nice time together for a while. Or they accept the differences in each other and either celebrate those differences, hey, I can learn from you and you can learn from me, or ignore those differences. Hey, you know, there's this part of you that, you know, I find problematic, but I can get past that. And that's when people are actually in love. That's a serious relationship. And the same thing in politics. You know, looking at President Obama and saying, you know, I think he's crazy on trade. But that doesn't mean that I'm going to divorce him. Right? He's really good in a lot of other areas. I'm going to try, you know, I'll either look over it, I'll look past it, I'll try to change it. Now, in politics, you can try to change things. In relationships, don't even try. This is a matter of acceptance or stepping away, because you can't change other people. You can only change yourself. here's the irony, though, the amazing irony. When you change yourself, the people around you change. But I digress. I mean, this is the beginning of a long rant about relationships. And well, actually, there's a political analogy to that, too. And I want to get to where Bernie fits into all of this, and I will in just a second. Because as we change ourselves, as for example, the Democratic base, the party base, starts speaking up about the things that really concern us, then our partner in the relationship, the Democratic Party, and its leadership, President Obama and others, they either change or they don't. I mean, this is Chuck Schumer's speech a couple of weeks ago. There was just this mind-boggling, and Chuck Schumer is like the inside guy's inside guy. And it was such a mind-bogglingly populist speech that I had to read it to you on the air. So anyhow, that happens. Sometimes when people can't handle the differences, they feel actually rejected, and they form the circular firing squad. They act like dumped lovers. They start trashing the other person. Usually, though, that doesn't happen as infatuation just fades. So this is how people come together, and this is how love forms over time. Now, how do people break up? The breakup always starts with something called the cry unheard. This is Diane Vaughan's phrase from her book Uncoupling. And the cry unheard is where one partner in a relationship says, essentially, I don't feel loved anymore. Or I'm not getting what I need out of this relationship. But they very rarely say it in such a clear and explicit way, and the other partner very often doesn't hear it. So they might just be complaining about, hey, you're making me go to the Bolshoi, and I hate the Bolshoi. And for them, it's a really big deal, but the other partner thinks, oh, it's just, you know, small thing. It's a difference that we can overlook. And thus, the cry unheard, if the cry is not acknowledged, then it begins to fester. And distance starts to form between people. The initiator is actually in the process, the person who issued the cry, is actually in the process of decoupling. Whereas the partner is clueless, doesn't realize that this is happening. And as the initiator decouples, he or she actually begins to form amnesia, literally, can't remember the early days of the relationship about why did I fall in love in the first place? This is one of the first signs that uncoupling is real, that it's really happening. And again, this, you know, back to politics. Hey, don't you remember why you liked Obama in the first place? That sort of thing. Then comes along another. This is Diane Vaughan's phrase. A guide may come along. Typically, it's a best friend. It can be a lover. It can be an affair or something like that. And then there's this process called going public, or it could be just to one person, but it's where the initiator says, I'm not happy in this relationship over here. And that's where I think many of us have been with the Democratic Party for the last couple of years, especially with this TPP stuff. And in fact, the initiator may even say, you know, I feel dead inside. I don't remember the relationship. And in politics, this is why you have 20%, 25%, 12% in some communities, Democratic Party participation in the elections. Right? They're I'm not there anymore. So then the initiator, the person whose cry was unheard, springs this on the partner. The partner freaks out. This is the point at which then negotiations begin that may lead to a better relationship, but more typically lead to a breakup. And so, who might that guide be for the Democratic Party? Could it be Bernie Sanders? Are we watching this arc of relationship being overlaid on the arc of politics? I had a little more to rant about this. I'll pick it up in 5 minutes.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
And in fact, there's a way to recover the relationship, as it were. We'll talk about that, too. Welcome back. 15 minutes past the hour. Robert in Bullhead City, Arizona, watching Free Speech TV on DirecTV. Hey, Robert, what's up?
Hey, good morning, Tom. Listen, about Bernie Sanders and everything, you spoke last week about Obama being about 14 to 18%, and where Mr. Sanders is right about there right now. And, you know, I really don't know if he's going to be able to hit the presidency, but I do believe that he's going to bring some important things to the board.
Right. So a question for you, Robert. A question for you in the context of the rant that I just did.
Yeah.
Does Bernie jumping into the race make you suddenly feel excited about the Democratic Party in this election or not?
Well, is what I'd like to share. It makes me excited for the American people in general.
Right.
My plan is this. Let's get back to a patriotic party, one party, and have the Supreme Court dissolve any corporate money given to any presidential or any congressman or any senator, that they're all given equal time on any media, and let the actual American citizen vote put in what they want as the president.
Wow, you just gave me an insight, Robert. I wonder if the cry unheard in the case of the American people with regard to politics, why do Americans engage in politics in such lower numbers than pretty much any other advanced democracy in the world? Why is it? And could it be that cry unheard is coming out of Citizens United in a way? You know, it's coming out of the politics. Well, it really goes back to 76 with Buckley versus Vallejo, when the Supreme Court first legalized the purchasing of politicians by billionaires, by saying that money is protected by the First Amendment, even though the First Amendment doesn't have the word money in it anywhere, and spending money for politics. And so could it be that the cry unheard basically is all of us, or not all of us, but many Democrats, progressives, liberals, even Republicans saying, hey, wait a minute, Supreme Court, we don't like that behavior. You know, we don't think that's a good idea. And, don't want to play in this game. And then the uncoupling process has begun, and not just from a political party, but from the entire concept of American politics. I mean, more proof of this is that Congress's approval rating is 8% right now. It's been lower than it's ever been in history.
Ever. And see, and that's another one of my points, and I agree with you, Tom. It's the American people that are partly responsible for allowing this corporate America to come up into such big power. And I'm just wondering, Tom, maybe that we need to do some type of a reform, like Thomas Jefferson said, every 7 years, you know, rebellion or revolt or whatever.
Yeah, he said 19. Well, he said every 19 years, every generation should reform the United States and reform the Constitution. But yeah, and then he also talked about the cycles of rebellion and revolt going on over and over and over again if the core demands were not met. And I think he's talking about the same kind of dynamic, too. It's fascinating stuff. Robert, thank you for the call. Thought-provoking. I appreciate it. We'll be right back. I'll finish up my rant. They are. Welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you. And, you know, back to this rant about this, the parallels between romantic or even friendship relationships. By the way, friendships follow the same arc. Mentorships follow the same arc. This is just like, this is sort of wired into our DNA. It's the way that we dance with each other, essentially. And figuring out, you know, is this the right dance for me? Is this, you know, all that kind of thing. And for recoupling, and in fact, this was an exercise, and I share this with you with her permission. Louise used to walk couples through this exercise when she did couples counseling back in the 90s. And it was asking the person who's the initiator, the person who is moving away from the relationship, because typically the left behind partner is in shock and either very angry or very frightened, is asking the initiator, can you remember why and how you first fell in love with the other person? And then asking that person to describe the scene, the moment. Now, what that does, when you ask, you know, what did it look like? What did it smell like? What did it taste like? What did you hear? What did you feel? When those questions are asked, that pretty much forces the unconscious mind to let go of that memory, to release it into the conscious mind. And so the initiator, if it's successful, now many initiators, most initiators, if they're already way down the road and they just are, their mind is set on divorce or whatever, most initiators will then just say, no, I'm not going to go there. But many will remember that, and it provides them with an opportunity to break that cycle, to break the process, and basically kind of fall in love again. And to me, this is what Bernie Sanders is doing to the Democratic Party. He's saying to the Democratic Party, maybe as that guide, you know, as Diane Vaughan's guide, although the analogy is imperfect, but I think it's damn close. And I would love to get your thoughts on this. You know, have you experienced in your life, first of all, these cycles that relationships go through? I think they're universal. And secondly, have you experienced them politically? And third, where do you think this is all going? You know, and which brings us back to Bernie, because Bernie reminds us, at least those of us who call ourselves Democrats or feel an affiliation with the Democratic Party, why we fell in love with the Democratic Party in the first place. It's because of Social Security. It's because of Medicare. It's because of unemployment. It's because of a strong middle class. It's because of strong infrastructure. It's because, families could work because there was, function because there was enough money. With even a single wage earner could support a family. We had good manufacturing in this country. All these things, you know, literally the Democratic Party brought us. And I think over the last, you know, basically since the Clinton presidency, when Bill Clinton declared, you know, the end of welfare as we know it and began deconstructing along with Newt Gingrich, I mean, they were happy buddies in this. Deconstructing parts of both the New Deal and the Great Society, that a lot of people essentially fell out of love with the Democratic Party. And then a Barack Obama with his Hope and Change campaign, we came back. Oh, yeah, okay. But it was that Rorschach test. It was that infatuation thing. Now, the thing about Bernie is, you know, to use the language of relationships for this metaphor, is that I'm not infatuated with Bernie at all. I'm in love with Bernie because I know him. I know the areas where I disagree with Bernie. I know the areas that I wish he would change. I mean, there's very few and very small. And I can, you know, but I also, you know, have a, what, 20-year, close to 20-year history with Bernie. I mean, Louise and I moved to Vermont in 1996. Yeah, it's 19 years since the first time I met Bernie Sanders and shook his hand at a $5 for Bernie hot dog and beer thing that was down on the waterfront in Burlington, as I recall, that we just stumbled into because we were out taking a walk. Which raises a whole nother question, which I think is particularly fascinating, which is if a whole bunch of us fall in love with Bernie or have been in love with Bernie all along, because it's a deep and long-lasting and mature relationship now. It's not just an infatuation. And Bernie gets blown out by Hillary Clinton or some other candidate, and he drops out of the race. How many of us are going to become spurned lovers, as it were, you know, the circular firing squad, the anger, versus how many of us are going to behave in a more mature is not quite the right word, but I lack a better one for it, pragmatic, perhaps, way and say, well, okay, Bernie's not the candidate, but hey, any Democrat, I mean, Joe Manchin, any Democrat is going to be better than Scott Walker or Jeb Bush. I mean, it's just that simple, right? So we have this relationship with the Democratic Party. We have this relationship with, say, Hillary Clinton or whoever. And, you know, It wasn't the person that we love, and we can love them when we're with them. The old, what's the old Stephen Stills song? You know, love the one you, when you can't be with the one you love, love the one you're with. So, you know, when we can't talk to Bernie on the radio and we can't listen, you know, the 6 days out of seven on the week, when we're not hanging out with Bernie, who we really love, can we also love Hillary Clinton or Martin O'Malley or whoever else? I mean, whoever else ultimately ends up being the nominee of the party. In a way, it's a question, and I, you know, and it is possible to have multiple relations at the same time, and it is possible even to love multiple people. We all do. I love many of my friends deeply. I love my wife. I love my kids. I mean, this is part of being a mature human being. So, can we have our relationship with Hillary and with Bernie? Now, there are a lot of people who are just so black and white that they'll just say, no, can't do that. It's all or nothing. Carl Jung called them judgers. Only this is the extreme of that. This isn't just a normal Jungian judger. This is like a very, very small slice of the population. It's kind of the ISIS part of the population.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Call 202-536-2370.
Or in American politics, I'd call it kind of the Chris Hedges faction. You are either perfect or you're out of my life. You know, that kind of thing. Welcome back to the place where smart people get their news, the Tom Hartman Program. Okay, some subtleties in my metaphor, and then I want to pick up your phone calls and get your thoughts on this, because a lot of people want to weigh in on this. And I see that one of the one of our callers, and I'll let Quentin, you know, lay it out in greater detail, but this doesn't just apply to the Democratic Party. Okay. So, some subtleties here. Number one is it is possible to go through this and yet still maintain a relationship. So, we can still be tied to the Democratic Party and not tied to the candidate, or we could be tied to a candidate. I mean, Bernie's not even a Democrat, although now he's stepped into the party in those places where he has to be on the ballot. And still have a commitment, you know, to the other. It's almost like, you know, again, the love in politics is an imperfect analogy. I'll acknowledge that right up front. In a 100% world, but in a 70 or 80% world, I think it's a damn good analogy. And so, number one. Number two, Shano made this point to me during the break. He said, could it be that a lot of people who initially or reflexively didn't like Hillary Clinton didn't like soap because they felt that it was a prearranged marriage being forced on them? Which raises a really interesting question, because prearranged marriages in many parts of the world actually have a higher rate of long-term success than do falling-in-love marriages, which is a whole other topic that we've done shows on. And I didn't even believe until I you know, read the books and saw the stats on it. And then finally, the big challenge in a relationship that is in which one of the couples is uncoupling. And by the way, the uncoupling doesn't have to be from the entire relationship. It can be from just one dimension of the relationship. In talking in relationships, people could uncouple, say, for example, physically or sexually, and still be coupled as friends or as partners or what, you know, whatever. Or people can uncouple as friends, they say, you know, but still be romantic. I'm pushing the metaphor to the boundaries here. I'll stop at that point. But my point about the amnesia is that in an uncoupling relationship, the amnesia about whatever part of the relationship that's falling apart becomes very, very serious. I mean, it's like people literally can't remember the good times. And is Bernie the spark that has caused us to remember that the Democratic Party brought us and the Republican Party opposed Social Security, Medicare, the Peace Corps, unemployment insurance, civil rights, student grant and loan programs, safety laws, Occupational safety laws, environmental laws, prevailing wage laws, the right to collective bargaining, paid medical insurance, paid vacations, pensions, workers' compensation, the Marshall Plan, flood disaster insurance, school lunch programs, public schools for that matter, women's rights, the Fair Standard Labor Standards Act, the minimum wage, child labor laws, the 40-hour work week, the weekends. Democrats brought us weekends. USDA programs, FHA, the Farmer Home Administration. This is back when the banks refused to make rural loans because they didn't want the bother. Flood control, rural water districts, rural electricity. I mean, all this stuff. Could it be that Bernie is breaking that amnesia? And is there something like that happening over on the right, too? That's a very interesting one. Or is it that what's going on the right that, Quentin in Palestine, Texas, you had some thoughts on this and you wanted to relate it to the Republican Party and the Tea Party. Do I have that right?
Yes, sir. It appears that we had a case study there that during the 2008 election campaign, before Obama was even elected, under George Bush's administration, the first Tea Party rallies were held, and they were rallying against the bailouts to the banks.
Right.
But their silent scream had previously occurred. They were upset over the deficit spending on the war, and the war in and of itself.
So there was a cry unheard within the Republican Party that turned into the Tea Party, that turned into the spurned lovers, as it were.
And then they recoupled because the Republican Party reminded the Tea Party that they both have this common connection of, you know, immigrants, minorities, liberals, communists. We hate them together, so we get back together.
Right.
And they managed to succeed in that.
Yeah, I think you're absolutely right, Clinton.
The same thing now with her populism.
Yeah, I think you're absolutely right.
Reconnect.
So my metaphor is making sense. That's fascinating. Thank you very much, Quentin. Great to hear from you. Steve in Chicago. Hey, Steve, what's up?
Yes, and I think your analogy, you know, it's not a bad one. I mean, you know, imagine that you have a daughter, okay, and she's dating the honor roll student. Great, you're ecstatic about it. And for one reason or another, it doesn't work out. And then she has some sort of a flirtation with a kid that you find out is almost certainly heading to prison at some point in the future. And she then settles into a relationship with the football player. He's a kid who likes to drink on the weekends. He's certainly not, you know, a Rhodes Scholar, or certainly not going to be, as opposed to the honor roll kid. So, you know, you sort of settle in, you know, with that kid because you realize that it could have been a lot worse.
Right.
And I think that that's where we're at, you know, when it comes to Hillary for a lot of people that, you know, in military parlance, they call it a holding action. In other words, okay, if we're forced to make these choices, you elect Hillary, well, at least she'll hold the current ground.
Yes.
And looking ahead, the demographic changes in this country, which I would argue have helped to manifest the right wing, because in many ways, in another analogy here, you know, there's nothing more dangerous than a wounded animal. I think the right in this country realizes that it's...
Well, let me if I may, Steve, there's also nothing more dangerous than a spurned lover. I mean, ask any cop. The most dangerous position, even though policing is not among the 10 most dangerous or deadly professions in America, there is still an element of danger. And the most dangerous situation, any cop will tell you, is walking into a domestic dispute. This is where more cops are killed. This is where more spouses are killed. People will kill for love or around rejection of love. And, you know, it's serious stuff.
A person who is the most respected member of a community who would never do anything antisocial in their life, you know, will, you know, hurt or possibly even kill their significant other. You know, it's amazing. You know, this happens in the best zip codes, unlike other kinds of crimes.
Sure.
But, you know, going back to my point that, yeah, you know, there is a little bit of a difference in that, you know, unlike lovers, you know, it falls upon us to, you know, fall in love with one other person and they with us. And, you know, we all have, you know, looked at a couple and said to ourselves, God, how could anyone stand either one of those two, yet they manages to work for them? As opposed to a candidate, you know, so, you know, we're attached to a candidate for 4 years, maybe eight. And, you know, beyond that, you know, we've got to look forward. And again, going back to what I said in terms of, you know, the changes that are going to happen in this country, you know, Fox viewers are in their late 60s. They literally have an audience that's going to be dead in a little over 10 years.
Yeah, the average age of a Fox viewer is 71 years old right now, I believe.
Right. I thought it was in the late 60s, but obviously we could be.
Might be 69. We're
pretty close in either case. And the point being that, you know, they're analogous to a wounded animal, and with, you know, people who are older tend to be the ones that are voting. So, you know, what you get is a disproportional conservative representation in this country in terms of power that in no way reflects, you know, where this nation is in terms of young people, middle-aged right. people, and also, you know, of course, the structural issues, which, you know, I mean, Bernie Sanders can certainly tell you about, you know, I mean, the very small percentage.
Good points, Steve. And let me add one thing about the Fox News viewers. You say they're more likely to vote. This could be one of the ways where the Republican voter suppression machine that requires, you know, a current driver's license and expired driver's license won't work, but you must have a current driver's license to vote. Increasingly, those Fox viewers can no longer maintain their driver's license. And pretty soon, in a lot of these Republican states, their base, the Fox News watchers, will be too old or infirm to vote because the Republicans have made it hard for old people to vote because they were concerned that people on Social Security would not like the Republican efforts to privatize Social Security. So they may be cutting their own legs out from underneath them. It's fascinating. It's fascinating stuff. Steve, thank you for the call and a very thoughtful analysis. Edward in Elmont, New York. Hey, Edward, what's up?
Hi. I stole this saying from a competing liberal radio host, and I love this so much, I share it with everybody I can. Here it goes. When you during a primary, you fall in love. Your candidate's the one, that's it, you know, and go on. But at the end, when it comes to the election, you fall in line.
Oh, is it Peter B. Collins said that?
No, it was Randy Rhodes.
Oh, Randy. Yeah, of course. Yeah, Randy's brilliant.
Excellent. And I do miss her, but don't worry, I'm still with you.
Yeah.
The point is that fall in line on the election, these are the things you believe in, and that's what you go for.
Yeah, yeah. Excellent. Edward, thank you for sharing that. Thomas in Flint, Michigan. Hey, Thomas, what's up?
Hey, Tom. Hmm? I just wanted to make 2 points, actually. The first one, I feel like I'm a polygamist with the Democratic Party. There's always somebody better than the Republican. So, you know, there's that. Bernie, Hillary, they're always going to be better than the Republican.
Right.
So, but I watched Mike Huckabee give his announcement.
Right.
And I'm curious, and I'll hang up so you can answer.
Let me go off on that rant about Mike Huckabee in 4.5 minutes. Is that all right, Thomas?
Okay, not a problem.
Okay, great. Because I just got the article. Danielle just printed it out for me, and it's a doozy. Thanks a lot. We'll be right back.
You're listening to Tom Hartman. Visit TomHartman.com for audio and video archives.
So what kind of relationship are you in with the Democratic Party, or the Republican Party for that matter? I'd love to hear from Republicans and Tea Party. And welcome back. Cliff in Claremore, Oklahoma. Hey, Cliff, you are, if I'm reading the notes here that Danielle wrote down from when she answered your phone call, it sounds like you are taking my interpersonal relationship metaphor and applying it to Muslims and Republicans and Pam Geller.
Absolutely, because one time back in the 70s and 80s and even 90s, the Muslims in this country voted Republican by large numbers. And, I mean, any time you went to a George H.W. Bush campaign or a Bob Dole campaign or even Ronald Reagan's, there were a lot of Muslims that were loyal Republicans. And because their religion is conservative, that many of them.
Dearborn, Michigan.
By the fundamentalists.
We used to live in the suburb next door to Dearborn, which has a huge, not just Muslim, but mostly Arab Muslim population.
Sure.
And yeah, it was reliably Republican. I mean, that was back in the 70s when we lived there. I don't know now.
And, you know, that just shows you how backstabbing the Republicans are.
Because now you've got people like Pam Geller, who is, you know, supported by, you know, Fox News. I'm increasingly calling them the official voice of the Confederate States of America. I used to call them the official voice of the GOP. I think it goes way, way worse than that. And so the Republicans used to say, you Muslims, we Christians and Jews, we all share a common denominator in that we're all the people of the book. We're all monotheists. We're all the children of Abraham. So, you know, let's work together. And we all have certain values in common, you know, going back to the Ten Commandments and whatnot. And now the Republicans are, you know, now that the Republicans have declared war in half a dozen Muslim countries, starting with Libya and Reagan, as I recall. In fact, I've got a note from a friend of mine who's a Muslim who lives in Tunisia that I was going to share with you. I'll do it the next hour on this program. But now the Republicans have so broken that relationship with American Muslims that they have created an amnesia about when they used to love each other or like each other or be friends or whatever.
Absolutely.
Yeah, I think that's brilliant. That's an absolutely brilliant analysis. Thank you, Cliff, for the call. Corky in Hilton, New York. Hey, Corky, what's up?
Oh, Tom. Yeah, I can't bring myself to support Hillary Clinton because of her relationship with the big banks.
So are you going to vote for Scott Walker or Jeb Bush?
No, of course not.
Well, if you don't vote for whoever the Democratic nominee is, and it might be Hillary, it might be Bernie, who knows, but if you don't vote for the Democratic nominee, you might as well vote for the Republican.
Well, I look at it this way. The Republicans are a bunch of thieves who run with thieves. And if Hillary Clinton's going to have that relationship with the banks, who are a bunch of thieves, then you're running with a bunch of thieves. It just stay out of the presidential part of it.
So what would Hillary have to say and then hopefully do in order to get your vote, Corky?
Is to go after the big banks like Elizabeth Warren. Start saying, we want to break you up.
Yeah.
You're destroying this country with your...
Okay, so the follow-up question, Corky, if she wants to be president of the United States and let's say she wants to do really good stuff like break up the banks, should she say that right now and lose all their money?
Yeah, I mean, when are we going to get some honest politicians? I think we've got one in
Bernie. The question is, when are we going to get an honest political system? And that's where the Supreme Court has done so much damage. We no longer have a political system in which an honest person really has a serious chance of winning, unless it's a real long shot. Welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you. And Kevin in Santa Fe, New Mexico, listening on KTRC. Hey, Kevin, what's up?
You know, I'm listening to Carly Fiorina speak, and she says that government is a bureaucratic mess. And by the way, I want you to vote for me to run it. And I just don't understand this phenomenon. It started with Reagan, you know, about the scariest words in the English language. They detract government, and they say it just doesn't work. It doesn't do anything, but for me to be the head of it, and it's like, oh, by the way, Obama had me at nuclear. And it's like, I don't understand why people vote for these Republican people who just want to destroy government. They'd like to change the Bible so they can beat it with a rod no thicker than their thumb.
Yeah, I'm going to talk about that, actually, in the next hour, that 57%, I think it is, of Republicans right now want to tear up the Constitution and make America a, quote, Christian nation. I mean, this is the fear-mongering that's being done on the right. But as to your question of why Republicans vote for people who say government is awful, let me run government, is because they're suckers. They have been brought in by the well-paid shills, because the Republican Party is wholly owned by the billionaire class in the United States, the billionaire class and the transnational corporations. They so completely wholly own the Republican Party that you cannot find a Republican in national political office. And frankly, I doubt there's any in any state houses around the country who will even acknowledge that global climate change is happening. Ben Carson just announced yesterday announced that he's running for president of the United States as a Republican, a neurosurgeon. He's got a medical doctor's degree, MD, medical doctor, as in like PhD, you know, doctor of philosophy or doctor of sciences, SD, whatever it may. He is a scientist. Medical doctors by definition are scientists, right? When asked about evolution and climate change yesterday, Carson said, I'm not a scientist. This is like now the standard shtick. The Republican Party is so owned by by the fossil fuel billionaires like the Koch brothers, who inherited a fossil fuel empire from their father. It is so owned by them that they are unable to say what they know to be true. I mean, how can a medical doctor say he doesn't believe in evolution and yet then counsel his patients not to take excessive antibiotics because the bacteria will mutate in your body and become antibiotic resistant? That's evolution. So the Republican Party is so completely owned at the level of the shills, which is the politicians, so completely owned by the billionaires that they have to say things that they know are lies in order to bring along the suckers. And the suckers, of course, being the fundamentalist Christians who don't believe in evolution. And you know, there's not really a constituency for denying climate change out there. It's they're creating one in order to protect the profits of the fossil fuel industry. But I think that that's the great mystery of why Republicans, in quote, why Americans vote for Republicans, even though the Republicans are saying government is awful. The other piece of it is that there has to be, there always has to be a balancing power to something, right? Whenever one thing stands, you know, emerges and just consumes all the, and Kevin, thank you for the call. Excellent question. Whenever one thing emerges and just starts consuming all the energy from an organism, you know, if a bunch of cells or even one cell in your body says, you know, I'm going to take over. I'm going to start sucking up all the glucose and all the adenosine triphosphate and all the nutrient, you know, these are the primary energy nutrients, the ATP, ADP, AMP cycle and all this stuff. I'm going to take all this stuff and I'm going to reproduce like crazy. We call that cancer. And it's the same way in political and economic systems. So monopolies are cancer. And that's why in 1881 or 82 or whenever it was, Senator Taft, as I recall, no, it's Senator Sherman of Ohio, introduced the Sherman Antitrust Act, was to say, we're going to take this cancer out of our body economic, right? No more trusts. Reagan stopped enforcing the Sherman Antitrust Act in 1982. That was the end of small family-owned businesses in America. Prior to 1982, every strip mall was filled with locally owned businesses. Every downtown was full of family businesses. Many of them have been in the family for four, five, six generations, two, three, certainly. Now they're all gone. Try to find a family-owned business in any mall in America. Try to find a family-owned business in any downtown in America. Outside of poverty-ridden areas where you've got small family-owned businesses that are basically exploiting the community with huge prices, you know, in these food deserts, that's about it, number one. And number two, Huckabee, this is pretty amazing, the Associated Press. Huckabee advocates a national consumption tax, which is similar to a sales tax, to replace the existing federal taxes on personal income and payrolls, right? So people who earn, you know, an average income or even a low income spend 100% of their money. More than half of Americans save no money, or in the neighborhood of half of all Americans have no savings whatsoever and are not saving. They can't afford to. They spend everything. And so Huckabee wants to tax those people because every penny they spend will be taxed. But he doesn't want to tax people who make $1 million a year, $10 million a year, $100 million a year, because, you know, and don't spend that money because they're already spending all the money they can. It's like Nick Hanauer, the progressive millionaires guy. He said, you know, how many pairs of pants do I need? I don't need 10,000 pairs of pants. I could afford to buy them, but I don't need them. So what am I going to do? I'm going to put my money in my Swiss bank account, and it's not going to help anybody. I mean, I'm paraphrasing. But then it gets really toxic. Then the Associated Press writes, he rejects calls Huckabee for a minimum wage increase, saying his proposals will yield a maximum wage for workers. Now, this is where it's important to remind you about the Republican Party. The maximum wage is something that we've never had in the United States since 1787. Since we won the Revolutionary War. Before the Revolutionary War, England imposed a maximum wage both in England and in the United States. And the maximum wage was designed to keep workers in poverty so that they would not revolt, so that no middle class would emerge. Because keep in mind, back in the 1700s, this was the England that Dickens wrote. I mean, Dickens was in the 1800s in the Victorian era, you know, 70 years later, but it was fairly stable and static. And that maximum wage law guaranteed that nobody rose out of poverty. Mike Huckabee just proposed this.
You're listening to Tom Hartman.
Hey, friends, Tom Hartman here. Thanks so much for watching and listening to the program. The Tom Hartman program is brought to you in part by the following underwriters. Identity Guard. Count on us to help protect what makes you, you. WIX.com. Everyone deserves to have their own website. ITMTrading.com. America's source for rare coins and precious metals. BostonBeer.com. Boston Beer, maker of handcrafted beers. Geico.com. Providers of insurance. IdentityGuard.com, total protection. Quicken Loans, engineered to amaze. And EcoWine.com, your source for organic wine since 1980. These underwriters support our show, so please help by supporting the people who make this program possible. You can learn more at TomHartman.com.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
Welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you. Hey, just a quick reminder that Bernie Sanders, if you're in the D.C., Maryland area, you can join Senator Bernie Sanders, who, by the way, was not even mentioned. Well, I get, you know, we sort of went off on this yesterday, but, you know, not so much. Not even mentioned on NBC or CBS. In fact, over the weekend, you know, the Sunday shows, Meet the Press, they mentioned 12 presidential candidates. Many of them not even presidential candidates. Seriously, I mean, not even presidential. They're talking about people who haven't declared. They didn't mention Bernie Sanders' name. A whole hour discussion about American politics the week after a serious contender for the Democratic ticket jumps into the race and raises in the first 24 hours more money than Marco Rubio, Rand Paul, or Ted Cruz, the three announced at that point in time Republican candidates. As a Democrat, he's doing better than any of the Republicans, and all they talked about was the Republicans and Hillary Clinton on Meet the Press and Face the Nation. And if you want to complain about it, good luck. I can't find a place on the websites of either network where you can, you know, where they look for listener feedback. Because it's not a democracy. I mean, you know, our media is corporate. It's not democratic. Anyhow, back to Bernie. If you're in the D.C., Maryland area, you can join Bernie tonight for a discussion on the Republican budget that has been proposed in Congress. And I'm assuming he's going to talk, too, about his budget priorities. In fact, I can guarantee it. At a certain level, I do know Bernie pretty well. It's at the International Brotherhood of Electrical Workers Hall in Lanham, Maryland. It's at 6:30. This is at 4371 Parliament Place. The event's free, but if you RSVP through the senator's Facebook page, it will be appreciated. So go to Facebook, track down Senator Sanders, and let him know you might come visit. Okay. For this second hour, and we can continue talking about my first hour. Metaphor and thoughts and analogies and whatnot. It's just, you know, some interesting stuff there. But for our second hour, I wanted to talk about a couple of things. The first one being that 57% of Republicans want, Rickster wrote this headline for Democratic Underground, and it's brilliant. He said 57% of Republicans want to overthrow the government. Now, what is it's a bit of an overstatement. But public policy polling, which is one of the more reputable and nonpartisan polling companies in the United States that polls on public policy, on politics. This I'm reading here from bluntandcranky.wordpress.com. A public policy polling national survey conducted between February 20th and February 22nd of Republican voters found that an astonishing 57% of Republicans want to dismantle the Constitution and establish Christianity as the official national religion. Only 30% of Republicans oppose making Christianity the official national religion. Now, there is this thing called the Establishment Clause. It's in the Constitution. It isn't even part of the Bill of Rights. It wasn't added on later. This was the original Constitution as written, you know, in 1787, as ratified in 1789. It says Congress shall make no law respecting an establishment of religion. And then, of course, you know, in the First Amendment, it says, you know, Congress shall not interfere with your right to practice your religion, essentially. So if you vote Republican, you're voting against the Constitution, as Rickster points out over at DU. Now, what does this mean for America? That more than half of Republicans want to declare the United States a Christian nation. Think about that for a minute. Think about that really seriously. Think about that in the context of the debate in Egypt about whether Egypt is an Islamic republic or is it a secular republic with a lot of Muslims. Or you can think about the debate in Turkey. Is Turkey an Islamic republic or is it a secular republic? I'm quite sure, I believe, I'm no expert on Turkey, but I believe that Turkey presents itself as a secular republic. And in fact, there was a purge of the Muslims during Ataturk's time. But you look at these nations that identify themselves by their religion. Is that what America wants to be? And if so, what's the next step? Hitler officially declared, and I realize I'm stepping all over what's-his-name's law, Godwin's law. You know, whoever mentions Hitler first loses the argument. But this was one of the early things that Hitler did, was declare Germany a Christian nation, appointed Bishop Mueller as the, not the Mueller that I knew, but, you know, some guy named Bishop Mueller, as the Archbishop of the German Church, as the head of the German, as the Reichschurch. And used Christianity as the flag and banner and excuse for everything he did right up until the day he committed suicide. Just 10 feet away from my old friend Armin Lehman, who was the 16-year-old boy who brought Hitler the news that the war was lost. Armin died a few years ago. He wrote a brilliant book. You can find it over at Amazon.com on his time as Hitler's youngest courier. Armin and I used to travel all around the world. We've been all over Southeast Asia. We've been all across Europe, teaching seminars for travel agents. This was back in the early 80s when I owned, Louise and I owned a travel agency, and I was doing consulting work in the travel industry. But anyhow, do we want to go down that road and say this is a Christian nation? Do we want to have the problem that Israel has by defining itself as a Jewish nation, as a Jewish state, where the people who aren't Jewish are basically living in an apartheid situation? And even within the Jewish community in Israel, there's all this strife. I mean, look what happened over the weekend with the, Ethiopians? Or it was one of the African nations has a fair number of Jews who are black Jews. And they were protesting in the streets. They shut down parts of Jerusalem, saying, wait a minute, we're not being recognized. We're not being fully integrated into society. We're just as Jewish as you are. So where do Republicans want to take us with this? Massachusetts was overtly Christian. Massachusetts was, as I recall, by its constitution, a Christian state prior to signing the Constitution, ratifying the Constitution. And they used to hang witches. They would throw women in lakes and say, well, you know, if she drowns, she's innocent. If she floats, she's a witch. In which case, we're going to hang her. Heads I win, tails you lose. Is this really the Republican strategy now? See, this is how desperate the billionaires are to bring in the suckers. Is they've got to get their shills out there. Huckabee's a great one because he's a preacher. They got to get their shills out there saying, you're Christian? I'm Christian? This nation is Christian? To hell with everybody else. Where's Pam Geller when we need her, right? This is not the United States. And it also represents some really serious problems. It means that our school system, for that 57% of Republicans, it means that they never learned in civics class what secular means. They never learned in civics class what the Enlightenment of the 1600s, the 17th century was. They never understood the founding principles.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
In fact, I'll bet that 57% of Republicans do not know that Thomas Jefferson was more proud of having authored the Virginia Declaration of Religious Liberty than he was of being president. It's on his tombstone. Welcome back. Let's see here. Just lost my cursor. Where did it go? Oh, there it is. It's way down at the bottom. Max in Walterboro, South Carolina, watching Free Speech TV. Hey, Max, welcome to the program. What's on your mind?
Hey, Tom, how you doing?
Good.
We need more of these guys like you were talking about. What's his name? My memory's getting bad.
Bernie Sanders. Yeah.
We need to have a where they can duplicate Bernie Sanders about 100 times over. Because we need more guys like him.
Well, I'm telling you, Max, there are Bernie Sanderses all over this country. Bernie is not the only democratic socialist in America. He's not the only guy who believes that FDR was right and that FDR was setting this nation on a course to become a truly great country. There are politicians who share Bernie's perspectives in every state, in every city. As I've gone through the polling from the Progressive Change Institute, on virtually every position that Bernie has, from trade to wages to Social Security to Medicare to health care, on virtually every single one of those positions to our military, virtually every one of those positions, Bernie's positions are consistent with well over 50% and typically well over 70% of American voters, including Republicans. So I hope that, you know, whether Bernie becomes president or not, I think that one of the really cool fallouts of his becoming president is that progressive politicians all over the United States who watched Dennis Kucinich get marginalized and ridiculed very often and whatnot as he was trying to be the progressive voice inside the Democratic Party. And he did a good job. God bless Dennis. But we were still in that late 90s phase of thinking that, you know, maybe the Democratic Party is really the party of Jamie Dimon, you know, now what Bernie is doing is he's validating. I mean, the fact that he raised more money in his first day than the first three Republican nominees raised in each one of their first days, that validates for politicians all over the country, much like I think Shama Sawant, being elected to city council in Seattle validated progressive politics at the local level. So, yeah, I agree with you. Bernie is one of the greatest things to come along in a long, long time. And hopefully a really substantial knock-on effect will come out of this in that regardless of what happens from this moment forward, that Bernie is waking up. He is, you know, he has said he's in this for the movement. He's not in this for Bernie. He doesn't wake up every morning, look in the mirror and say, oh, it's the next president of the United States. You know, the old joke, every senator looks in the mirror in the morning and says, there's the next president. Bernie was not one of those people. But he does want the movement. And he is building the movement. And the movement is going to bring a whole lot of other Bernies in. And I think that that's a great thing. And if all those other Bernies and you and me and everybody else, you know, if we can help those other Bernies, the Mark Pocans of the world, the Sherrod Browns of the world, the genuinely progressive Democratic politicians, if we can help them, if we can move them forward, then, you know, it has been a great thing that Bernie does or did, has already done. Max, thanks a lot for the call. Thanks for watching Free Speech TV. I appreciate hearing from you. And we'll be right back. Okay, a few other things I wanted to share with you as we continue through our day. The next one is the New York Times. I talked about this, I believe, yesterday and perhaps even Friday. I think the article came out on Friday about the head of the Federal Election Commission saying, well, I'll give you the actual quote. "The likelihood of the laws being enforced is slim," said Anne Revell, the chairwoman of the Federal Election Commission. Now, $10 billion is probably going to be spent in this election in 2016. $10 billion. The Federal Election Commission is charged with oversight over how that money is spent. Already, there is evidence that crimes are being committed with regard to campaign finance, and the FEC is unable to do anything. In fact, here's how bad it gets. Steve Bannon over at the Maddow blog, Rachel Maddow's blog over on MSNBC, writes, "Last month, the Federal Election Commission was planning to hold an event, to host an event honoring the agency's 40th anniversary. In a dispute that seemed perfectly emblematic of the FEC's dilemmas, Democrats and Republicans on the commission couldn't agree on where to hold the gathering or what to serve for breakfast." Seriously. There are three Republicans and three Democrats, and it's majority rule. And the three Republicans are saying, essentially, if the billionaires are going to cheat in this election to get more Republicans elected, as they have done in past elections, by many indications, we, the Republicans on the FEC, are going to prevent the FEC from doing anything about it. So Anne Revell, who's a Democrat, who's the chairperson of the FEC, just said to the Koch brothers and to all the other, Shelley Adelson, all the other billionaires, the right-wing billionaires, the left-wing billionaires, although left-wing billionaires tend to be highly transparent, right-wing billionaires not so much, just said to all the billionaires, doesn't matter. Go ahead. It's as if the referees have left the field. You know, I often use football, soccer, baseball, you know, sports as a metaphor for our economy. An economy doesn't exist in a vacuum. It doesn't just magically appear out of nowhere. An economy is created, and there are rules created for that economy. An economy is established. There, you have, you know, here's what a contract means. Here's what a contract doesn't mean. Here's how a contract is enforced. Here are the courts to enforce, you know, the enforcement mechanism for that, for those contracts or for those agreements or deals or whatever. Our government plays a huge role in commerce in the United States. You walk into a store and steal something, the government will stop you. You can say, hey, it's a free market, right? No, it's not. It's a carefully regulated market. And, you know, one of the pieces of Reaganism is to destroy that regulation. And they've been quite successful at it, which is one of the reasons why the poor people are getting poorer, the middle class is getting poorer, and the rich are getting fabulously richer, because that was Ronald Reagan's job. The whole point of the Reagan Revolution was to turn America, to take America away from the middle class, which FDR had given it to, right? FDR not only created the American middle class, but then he handed the majority of the wealth, or a large chunk of the wealth in the United States, to the middle class. And in the years since Reagan, at least $14, $15 trillion has gone from the middle class straight to the top 1%. The rules of the game changed. That's the economic version of it. Well, there's also a political version of it. Politics is like sports, too. And I don't mean the who's going to win and who's going to lose thing. I mean, there have to be rules for the game. Can you imagine a football game where the team that had the most money could determine where their goalpost was set? The team that had the most money could determine how many men they could have on the field at, you know, at any given moment. Can you imagine a football game where one team says, we don't want any referees watching us? You can watch the other guys, or the other guys will voluntarily choose to play by the rules, but we're not going to. We're not going to voluntarily choose to play by the rules. That's today's Republican Party. It is a corrupt, I think RICO corrupt, criminal enterprise. And, or something damn close to it, a scam. And then you got the scammers like Mike Huckabee. There's a great piece on Politico today, the populist one percenter. Mike Huckabee was not a millionaire when he ran in 2008, but now he lives in a $3 million, 11,000 square foot beachfront mansion in Florida. He has spent over, where was it? I got to highlight these things. Over $250,000 in private jet air travel. I think my pen fell on the floor. $250,000 in private jets, Mike Huckabee. Much of it paid for by other people. Right? He's solidly in the 1% now. How did he get there? Running for president. I'm telling you, these every single person who has announced the run for president so far on the Republican side is not a serious candidate. They are serious hustlers who want to sell books and jack up their speaking fees.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Call 202-536-2370.
And in the meantime, try to get either a gig on Fox News or get become a Fox News commentator, which means every time they show up on TV, they get a couple $1,000. Welcome back. Borowitz Report here, courtesy of Andy Borowitz, writing for The New Yorker. In the Borowitz Report today, one day after the former Hewlett-Packard CEO Carly Fiorina announced her candidacy for the 2016 Republican presidential nomination, a new poll shows that she enjoys extremely high name recognition among the tens of thousands of former HP employees she fired. According to the poll conducted by the University of Minnesota's Opinion Research Institute, Fiorina's name recognition stands at 100% among the legions of employees she's terminated, with many of them calling the former CEO unforgettable. Additionally, a broad majority of the laid-off workers described their feelings about Fiorina as intense and noted that a very few days go by when they do not invoke her name in a vehement manner. Davis Logsdon, who supervised the survey for the University of Minnesota, said that Fiorina's entry into the Republican race had energized many former HP employees. Most of them were apathetic, he said, about the race before, but now they are very excited to see how it plays out for Carly Fiorina. Impressively, Fiorina's 100% name recognition among fired HP employees ranks her ahead of other names mentioned in the survey, such as Darth Vader at 99% and Satan at 97%. Thank you, Andy. Andy Borowitz. You can read it over at NewYorker.com. What a hoot. The DNC, a big and consequential announcement. This is great news, I think, for Bernie. And frankly, I think it's great news for Hillary Clinton as well. The Democratic National Committee just announced that they are going to hold 6 presidential debates. At least 4 of them will be in the early nominating states, Iowa, New Hampshire, South Carolina, and Nevada, and they're going to start this fall. So 3-4 months from now. Debbie Wasserman Schultz, the DNC chairwoman, said, "We have always believed that we would have a competitive primary process," which is, I find that interesting. "And that the debates would be an important part of that process. Our debate schedule will not only give Democratic voters multiple opportunities to size up the candidates for the nomination side by side, but will give all Americans a chance to see a unified Democratic vision of economic opportunity and progress, no matter whom our nominee may be." Well, that's interesting. I think it's maybe a little optimistic that everybody's going to say the same thing. Yes, we're all Democrats. I mean, this is what the Republicans do. They compete not to present positive ideas, but to talk about how much they hate Obama and Democrats. But the response from the Clinton campaign, Hillary Rodham Clinton's campaign, welcomed the development as a chance to debate the issues. So, step by step, right? We'll see where this thing goes. Todd in Anoka, Minnesota, listening on AM 950. Hey, Todd, what's up?
Hi, Tom. Thanks for taking my call. Nice to speak with you again.
Thank you.
Just 2 comments, if I may. I got a great thrill or laugh out of hearing Ben Carson use the fallback position that so many of the Republicans do, not only the presidential candidates, but Republican politicians in general, the fallback position on climate change by saying, "Well, I'm not a scientist, so I can't weigh in on it." But it's interesting that they, when they begin a discussion about the economy, they don't say, well, I'm not an economist, so I can't weigh in on that. Or if they begin a conversation about how to handle ISIL, they say, don't say, well, I'm not a military strategist.
Or a foreign policy expert.
On that. Yeah. Or tell us how the Constitution should be interpreted. They don't say, well, I'm not a constitutional scholar, so I can't weigh in on that. They seem to only use that fallback. They can give us their opinion on anything that they're not experts on, except climate change. There they feel they must be a scientist in order to weigh in.
Well, it was climate change and evolution, both. And they're really quite different things. With climate change, what he's saying is he's saying to the billionaires, I will do your bidding. I will be one of your highly paid shills to bring along the suckers on climate change. In other words, don't PO, don't anger the billionaires. So with climate change, they say, I'm not a scientist. With evolution, he's not shouting out to the billionaires. He's shouting out to the suckers. He's shouting out to the base that thinks that anybody who proclaims their Christianity must be a good person, and therefore we should put them in office. And he's saying to the fundamentalist Christians who think the world is only 6,000 years old, if I'm not one of you, I'm at least close enough to you that I accept you, and I'm not gonna diss you or contradict you or argue with you. And
you could say he's shouting to the donors and the primary voters.
Exactly, which I call suckers. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. And if I may, on one other thing, Tom. Often it seems that sometimes it seems to me like the progressives are a little bit shy to admit that we have billionaires that support our candidates as well. And I think we should just draw the distinction that when a very wealthy person decides to vote for progressive policies, they understand that it may affect their wealth. They're not voting against it. They believe that by expanding the wealth, that all boats will rise. Whereas on the other side, I think the extremely wealthy support the Republican candidates because they have to have their fists tighter around their money, and they're afraid that it might go elsewhere if someone else is elected.
Right. It comes down to one.
We should be proud to have wealthy donors on our side. They're supporting policies that will help everyone.
I agree. And let's not forget that both Teddy Roosevelt and Franklin Roosevelt were very rich guys. But the point is that it comes down to one basic choice that every billionaire in America has to make. Which is more important to them, living in a civil society, in a small d democratic, small r republic, or getting richer? Because you can't necessarily have both. Now, you actually, you know, the way that the system is set up right now, they can have both, but many of them choose not to even care about that first part. So
not like we didn't have wealthy people in America during the New Deal when the middle class was expanding, wealth expanded at the top also.
Yeah, I'm with you. Absolutely. Until Reaganism came along. And I'm going to stop calling it Reaganomics because it goes way just beyond economics. I'm calling it Reaganism because it's a religion. There's no evidence to back it up. In fact, all the evidence that is out there indicates that it's a failed and flawed policy. And you know, it's a theology, it's a belief system. It's not actually Reaganomics implies that there's actually a logic to it. You cannot logically defend Reaganomics. Just ask Sam Brownback. Todd, thanks for the call. John in Portland, listening on X-Ray FM. Hey, Todd, John, what's up?
Hi, Tom. Great show. And I think it's time for all of us citizens to grow up and get real and pragmatic. There ain't no perfect people, and there's going to be no president that's going to come down and save us. We need supermajorities in the Congress, Senate, and House to get anything done. And all of us need to be voter activists in talking with people and get them off this single-issue Christian stuff. And I'd like to go off on the Christians that are trying to control our government and us.
Mm-hmm.
Hey, if you don't like what we do as a society, as a government, as how we vote, do like the Amish and the Hutterites and other Christian sects, go pull your money and go buy 1,000 acres and move there.
Right. Or totally withdraw yourself from the political dialogue.
Amen.
Yeah.
And a good example is how close the vote can be is Oregon, small state, 7 electoral votes. In 2000, there was only 6,750 votes between Gore and Bush because 100 and some thousand people voted for Nader.
And that would have been such a tragedy to live in a state that voted for that idiot Bush and Cheney, who have wrecked this country.
Right.
And here's another good one.
That's the bad news. And by the way, Bernie's being in the Democratic primary is not going to, there's no parallel to Ralph Nader, because Ralph Nader ran against the Democratic Party. Bernie is running with the Democratic Party. If he doesn't make it through the primaries, he will drop out and he will support whoever the nominee is. He's already said that.
No, I really respect Bernie. He's one
he's
of
an
the
honest man.
Things that I've heard about. And another good one is, remember, folks, that the Bush-Cheney administration put a lot of these Oral Roberts Christian nutcases in our Justice Department. And Oral Roberts couldn't even get an accreditation for their law school for, I think it was quite a while, up until about, 5 years ago. Who knows if they even have it now. And this is what we're up against. This is an ideological war, and we can't handle these people. And I love the way you talk about the Republican Party, because they are our enemies of this country.
Yeah.
And we've got to do everything we can to get rid of these people. Another good one, Tom, is this this wonderful corporate media we have. Hey, folks, wake up. They're not going to tell you anything. I saw them Dean and Kucinich. Dean, they did that scream. Remember that?
Yeah.
And they, you can tell they played with the audio to eliminate him. Same with Kucinich. The first question, I forget the guy's name he passed on, the first question to Kucinich is, "What, do you believe in UFOs?"
Right.
You know, and,
here's the difference, though, John, and this is why Dennis Kucinich was, you know, a good man, but not a perfect candidate, in my mind, compared to Bernie, for example. Bernie may or may not believe in UFOs, but if somebody says, "Do you believe in UFOs?" Bernie is going to say, or I believe Bernie would say something like, "What does that have to do with the life of average people? We've got a problem in this country with the middle class being destroyed." Whereas Dennis Kucinich said, "Yeah," you know, and allowed that topic. See, Bernie uses everything as an opportunity to pivot to economics, because he understands the same as all the Republican, you know, the ownership class of the Republican Party understands, that religion doesn't matter, gender doesn't matter, race doesn't matter. None of those things matter until the money is taken care of. It's all about the money and keeping women down and keeping people of color down and all those things. That's just a way to make more money for Republicans, who are mostly rich white men.
You're listening to Tom Hartman. Visit TomHartman.com for audio and video archives.
Back with more of your calls after this. Welcome back. 15 minutes before the hour. And Ron, whoops, hang on just a second. There we go. Ron, watching Free Speech TV in Yoder, Indiana. Hey, Ron, what's on your mind?
Hi, Tom. Hey, I was just wondering what you thought about Bernie getting on the internet like Obama did, but between the ferns and with some of these popular bloggers of the young people.
I think it's a great idea. I think that Bernie, because Bernie is coming out of a place of fundamental and foundational honesty, he can handle any venue, because he doesn't have to worry about gotcha questions, because there's no gotcha to get.
Right.
You know? I think he should. I'd love to see more outreach to the millennials from the Sanders campaign, and I would be fascinated to see an age demographic breakdown of that initial 45,000 donors that in the first day, I think it was, who raised $1.5 million for Bernie.
Mm-hmm.
Are they principally boomers? Are they people basically my age? And I don't know you, Ron, but
yeah, that'd be fascinating.
Yeah. Are they boomers or are the millennials starting to get engaged? And is that middle generation, Gen X and Gen Y, are they getting engaged? Because they've been like apolitical forever.
Right. My son and daughters, they politics is nothing to them. They don't watch it. They're not interested in it. But I'm trying to get them interested in it. I'm trying to inform them. That's the problem we have. There's so many low and no informed people.
Right.
That's a big problem.
Yeah. Yeah. And in fact, one of the things that's radicalizing a lot of young people right now is the fact that, you know, you want to go to school? Good luck.
Yeah.
You will be broke. Yeah. You will not be able to buy a house. You will not, you know, and on it goes. So
my daughter's going through that right now.
Yeah. And, you know, all three of my kids have, and it's just, it's amazing. So I'm very hopeful, and Ron, you're spot on. And I hope that the Sanders campaign will be moving in that direction. Thanks a lot for the call. Stephen in Sioux Falls, South Dakota. Hey, Stephen, what's up?
Hey, Tom, about Christianity, I think we need to approach it differently. It was created by the Roman Empire as a tool of oppression.
The modern version of it, yes.
Yeah. If it was truly called Christianity prior to that, I'm not sure. I can't get the information.
It split into the early days, and there was a time in my life when I was just fascinated by this stuff and read a lot of Funk and Pagels, and you know, there was serious scholarly writing on this. And there were two churches in the early day. There was the Jesus Church, basically the followers of Jesus, the 12 disciples, and their followers. And then, and this is all after Jesus had been crucified. And then there was this guy named, you know, Saul, whose job was to kill these Christians, these followers of Jesus. And he had this road to Damascus, you know, epiphany, or the road to Ephesus, I guess, whatever it was. He had this epiphany and decided to start his own version of Christianity. And the Jesus version of Christianity was replaced by and died out, and was replaced by the Pauline version of Christianity, which is what we have now. And there have been some attempts by some people, and principally Jesus scholars, using things like the Book of Thomas and the Dead Sea Scrolls, to bring back the original Christianity. But it's not what you find in most churches. Stephen, thanks for the call. Welcome back. 10 minutes before the hour. Let's check in with the Talk Radio News Service, talkradionews.com, and find out what the news of the day is. This report brought to you by goatsfortheoldgoat.com, where this Mother's Day coming up, you can give a crystal heart to your mother. It's a mother-to-mother program through goats from the oldgoats.com. Bring your mom crystal goats or a goat for a mother who's hungry. This is the South Sudan charity that Ellen Ratner started. And I am so pleased to have Victoria Jones. You're not in the White House. You're not someplace else. Nope. You're right here in the studio,
right
sitting
here,
next to me.
Right now.
It is so cool.
Yeah.
Hey, so what's going on in the world?
There's a lot going on in the world, Tom.
Okay.
Okay, so it was a man whose social media presence got to the attention of authorities, but not before the Texas Muhammad Cartoon Contest shooting, even though he did, in fact, it seems, send a tweet. We're talking about Elton Simpson and his cohort Nadia Sufi, who had not come to the attention of authorities. Now, they wounded a security officer before they were shot and killed at the scene. But there's something interesting about this. And Elton Simpson was a bad guy. Mm-hmm. There's no question he was a bad guy. He was caught on tape for 1,500 hours with an FBI informant saying some pretty inflammatory stuff, if you read the Daily Mail article from yesterday. Well, but when they prosecuted him back in 2010, they only used 17 minutes of it, and he only got probation. But interestingly, they were wearing body armor. One shot the security officer in the leg. Garland police spokesman said a single Garland police officer subdued them, but then SWAT officers nearby also fired at the two men, killing them after they were subdued. And strangely, police do not know who fired the lethal shots.
Wait a minute. So these guys were rendered incapable of being a threat, and then they were killed by the police?
This is what it appears from spokesman Joe Hahn. The AP article says a single Garland police officer subdued the two gunmen, but that after his initial shots, SWAT officers nearby also fired at the two men. Police do not know who fired the lethal shots.
So enough SWAT officers shot that it was sort of like a firing squad where nobody knows whose bullet actually killed the guy.
It seems that that's the
case. And they're apparently not bothering to do the forensic work to match the bullets to the rifle casings.
It doesn't appear to be that
remarkable.
That's the case. I find that very interesting.
I do, too.
And that's not
and
being
I would
reported.
I would have loved to have seen these guys interrogated. I would have loved to have seen a trial. I would love to have seen the the backstory on their conversion or whatever?
Well, yes, because one of them, I think, grew up Muslim, Elton Simpson, converted, and ISIS has today taken responsibility, has claimed responsibility for this shooting. We don't know whether that is a bogus, oh, we did it claim, or whether there is any reality to it at all, and we'll never know.
Yeah. Yeah,
we'll never know. Democratic presidential candidate Hillary Clinton, who is meeting on today, Cinco de Mayo, in Nevada with young people at Rancho High School in Las Vegas, where about 70% of the student body is Hispanic, will today say that a true fix to the nation's immigration system would need to include a full and equal path to citizenship, and that the nation should not settle for proposals that would provide hard-working people with a second-class status.
Wow, that's great.
Yes.
Now, that's also kind of solidly right in the middle of the sweet spot of the Democratic Party these days, isn't it?
Yes, it is. It's further, I think, than she has gone before.
Yeah. Right, but it's and it's going to make the Republicans crazy. I can see the Drudge headlines now. Brown people going to... Black people, brown people are going to take your jobs.
Yes. Also, she is now supporting state policies that allow driver's licenses, which she did not do the last time that she ran.
Several states have done that now.
Yes, several states have done that. Yeah. Several states have done that. Also, Democrats running for president will participate in six primary debates organized by the Democratic National Committee, party leaders announced today.
Yeah, I just mentioned that.
You just mentioned that.
That's a good one.
Mike Huckabee, former Arkansas governor, Republican, the other man from Hope, is running for president.
Now, I have a question about that. I read that piece here just a moment ago, and he said that he doesn't support a minimum wage. He supports a maximum wage. Now, I don't know how well-versed you are in your British law history, but there was a maximum wage in England through the 16th, 17th, and 18th centuries, and it was one of the things that the Americans rebelled against because they tried to impose it in the colonies. They did impose it successfully in many of the colonies, and the goal of the maximum wage was to tell employers, you may not pay your employees enough that they can rise out of poverty. It was to keep...
Whoa!
It was because they correctly viewed the emergence of a large middle class as a politically destabilizing element. And so the maximum wage laws in England for 300 years were in place to prevent a middle class from emerging, to prevent a serious political challenge to the ruling class. Is that what Mike Huckabee's talking about?
I do not know. And I think you should interview him and quiz him about that.
I would love to know.
I think you should quiz me about that. I started to take economic history and did rather badly at it. My professor was called Dougal.
Okay.
That's all I remember.
So blame it on Mr. Dougal?
I should blame it on Mr. Dougal. I really should, yes. Okay. Senate Majority Leader Mitch McConnell, Republican of Kentucky, today blasted Minority Leader Harry Reid's fresh Democratic effort to slow down legislation that would speed trade deals through Congress. He's saying the Senate will soon take up the bill.
This is one of the things I love about Harry Reid. He has opposed these trade deals all the way back to NAFTA, and he's not happy with this one.
No, he's not happy with this one. Reid is saying, well, Democrats will block this trade promotion authority until the Senate passes infrastructure and surveillance program measures.
Right.
I don't know whether they're going to be able to do it, but that's what he says they're going to do. And McConnell says, oh, of course, we've already heard of an attempt to stand in the way of the bipartisan effort to debate this legislation. And he says it's just simply not going to happen.
Right.
Meantime, debate on the budget is opening. And Senator Ted Cruz was the only 2016 Republican presidential hopeful to miss a procedural vote today that opened up debate. Cruz is getting a bad rep for missing a lot of votes.
Yeah, he's missed a lot of votes, and usually it's because he's at a fundraiser someplace.
There was no explanation for it.
Amazing. Victoria Jones of the Talk Radio News Service, talkradionews.com. Thank you, Victoria.
Thank you.
It's great to have you in the studio. And she's guest hosting Leslie Marshall. Is it today?
Today and tomorrow.
Today, right after this show and tomorrow. Great. Have a wonderful time.
You're listening to Tom Hartman.
Hey, friends. Tom Hartman here. Thanks so much for watching and listening to the program. The Tom Hartman program is brought to you in part by the following underwriters. Identity Guard. Count on us to help protect what makes you, you. WIX.com. Everyone deserves to have their own website. ITMTrading.com. America's source for rare coins and precious metals. BostonBeer.com. Boston Beer, maker of handcrafted beers. Geico.com. Providers of insurance. IdentityGuard.com. Total protection. Quicken Loans, engineered to amaze. And EcoWine.com, your source for organic wine since 1980. These underwriters support our show, so please help by supporting the people who make this program possible. You can learn more at TomHartmann.com.
This is the Tom Hartmann Program.
Welcome back. Tom Hartmann here with you. A couple of things I wanted to talk to you about. And, you know, we'll kind of put on the table things that we can discuss. I have shared with you before some emails, some very, very thoughtful emails that I've gotten from a correspondent, a friend, I guess. You could say, in Tunisia. And I just got a really thoughtful email from him that I wanted to share with you. He's the fellow, let me read this, and then, you know, I'm not sure. Actually, you know, I want to get his permission before I read it. I'm not going to read it on the air. But because it has to do with the crazies in Islam, and he's in the middle of, you know, a country where there are some people who may want to hurt him. The New York Times pointing out, and Dardigan wrote a great blog about this over at Daily Kos today, that conservative economics are literally killing us. I mean, literally killing us. Now, I don't think we should call them conservative economics because they have nothing to do with classic conservatism. And frankly, they have nothing to do with real economics. It's Reaganism. It's an ideology, a belief system unsupported by facts or evidence that is destroying America. Let me just, you know, share some of the things here that, you know, from Dardigan's post over at DU. That and then, you know, that include pieces from this New York Times piece over the weekend. 35 years ago, babies born in the U.S. had an infant mortality rate equal to Germany. Okay? Before Reaganism set in, if a child was born in the United States, now people say, you know, we've got, you know, terrible birth, you know, infant mortality, terrible infant mortality in the United States. And the Republican response is, yeah, it's all, you know, poor people and black people and stuff like that. And, you know, they brought it on themselves, blah, 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 blah. Well, I'm sorry, 35 years ago, we were the same as Germany, a fully developed country. We were a fully developed country. They were a fully developed country. Today, American babies, and by the way, this includes white poor areas as well as black poor areas and Hispanic poor areas. Today, American babies die at twice the rate of Germany. Just let that sink in for a minute. 35 years ago, the United States ranked 13th in life expectancy for girls among the 34 industrialized countries. Now, that's not great. We always thought we were exceptional and wonderful and we're the best country in the world. We were 13th. Now, 35 years into our experiment with Reaganism, we are 29th out of those 34 countries. And those 34 countries include some fairly, I mean, you know, the developed countries of the world include places like, you know, there's just a whole bunch of them anyway. We have the highest teenage, like Costa Rica, for example, is what I was looking for. We have the highest teenage birth rate among the industrialized world. Did you see that I don't have the headline in front of me, so I can't give you the details on this, but there's another interesting story out there about how a school district somewhere in the United States. There is a school district where they're teaching abstinence only education, and right now they're having an epidemic of chlamydia. An estimated 10% of the entire student body has chlamydia. Because apparently in the abstinence-only education, they came in and said, oh, you know, you don't have sexual intercourse and condoms don't work and all this kind of thing. And so the kids are doing things orally and stuff, and it's not, you know, it's kind of messy. One out of every four children, this is the stupidity of not actually teaching people how their reproductive systems work. One out of every four children in this country lives with a single parent, the highest rate of any country in the industrialized world. And what is it that breaks up marriages? Typically, money. I mean, there are a lot of stressors in marriages. But the biggest stressor in terms of the percentage, it's well over half of all marriages that fall apart over arguments over money. Or simply the lack of money, the inability to make it. Our incarceration rate in the United States is 300% higher than it was the day Ronald Reagan came into office. Reagan, you will recall, put the war on drugs, a.k.a. the war on black people, put that on steroids, really cranked it up. Minimum mandatory sentencing, different sentencing for crack cocaine, because that's more, at that time, that was more used in the black community. I mean, the war on drugs has, we have 300%, three times more people in our prisons than any other industrialized country in the world as a percentage of our population. Why do our children die at a rate faster than European kids? Staggering rates. This was the conclusion from economists from the University of Chicago, from the Massachusetts Institute of Technology, MIT, and the University of Southern California. They got together and they conducted research on why American children die more frequently than kids in France or Germany or Denmark or Sweden or Costa Rica. And what they found, I'll quote you from the report. This was published by the National Research Council and the Institute of Medicine. On nearly all indicators of mortality, survival, and life expectancy, the United States ranks at or near the bottom among high-income countries. What's most shocking about these statistics is not how unhealthy they show Americans to be compared to citizens of countries that spend much less on health care and have much less sophisticated medical technology. What is most perplexing is how stunningly fast the United States has lost ground. Keep in mind, we were on a positive trajectory. I mean, the last time Republicans had their revolution was in 1920 when Warren Harding campaigned on less government, less government in business, more business in government, was his phrase. In other words, privatize, deregulate. And on dropping the top income tax rate from 91% down to 25%. He did all of those things in his first year in office in 1921. And for 9 years, we had a Republican revolution. It was the first Reagan revolution in America. And what happened? It created the Great Depression. Now we're doing it again. We're 35 years into it this time. It didn't take 9 years. It took 35 years. Arguably, much of the resilience that FDR and the New Deal built into our economic and political systems is still there. But the Republicans have been so aggressively taking this thing apart. This is how fast we have fallen apart. And when I say Reaganism, I'm not just talking about his tax cuts for the rich, his tax cuts for corporations, his encouraging corporations to pay their CEOs and senior employees with stock rather than salary, so they pay lower tax rates, and so their loyalty to their company, their customers, their employees, and their community vanishes, and they become obsessed with nothing but making themselves rich. I mean, Reagan single-handedly essentially created this billionaire class that we have. It's not just that. It was the beginning of the whole permanent normal trade relations thing, the earliest free trade stuff. This is part of Reaganism, too. This is why I say, yeah, we had a Democratic president for 8 years. You know, in Bill Clinton, and we've had one for 6.5 years in Barack Obama, but it's still, we're still living in the era of Reaganism. And until we repudiate Reaganism, we're screwed. And so now Hillary Clinton finds herself in this really tough place. The Republicans, and you see this over at Drudge Report where they're kind of bragging about it, the Republicans want to take her down by getting her to support this latest trade deal, which is just, in my opinion, another extension of Reaganism.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
And if she does it, it's going to wipe her out with her base. And then the Republicans are going to start campaigning. After they pass the trade deal, they'll start campaigning against it. Welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you. And, oh my. Oops. Dropped myself into the chat room instead of the call screen software. Let's pick up some phone calls here. Whoops. Here we go. Anita, watching Free Speech TV in San Antonio, Texas. Hey, Anita, what's up?
Hey, Tom. I know how you've referred to the Republican Party as a cult.
Mm-hmm.
Do you think that cult is Reaganism?
Yes. I think Reaganism is probably the major piece of the cult in the Republican Party.
They have to refer to him, like, I don't know how many times in every speech, or God help them. They name everything after him. The reality of Reagan, they just deny, or they just, you know, pretend it doesn't exist.
Yeah.
To me, it is very much like a cult.
Yeah, it's, and it's, and nobody's calling it Reaganism, which is why I'm trying to start this meme that you know, that this is actually a cult. And it's, in a way, it's a death cult. It's a cult that celebrates death. I don't know how to describe it other than that. It's really amazing. And, you know, thus Reaganism. So, yeah, I'm with you, Anita.
Very weird.
Say what?
Yeah. It's very weird. I mean, they tried to, remember Facebook, they tried to make a Reagan book, like Reagan, you know, instead of Facebook, where people that love Reagan could gather or something. I don't know.
Yeah. Yeah.
But people just,
well, the Reagan Legacy Project lives on. You know, they now have succeeded, I believe, in naming a building after, or putting a statue up to Ronald Reagan in every county in America, and now they're working on every country in the world. I doubt they've gotten to North Korea yet, but who knows? Who knows?
I'm sure there's a planet, you know.
Yeah. Yeah. The next step will be to put a statue of Reagan on the moon. Anita, thank you for the call. George in Shady Point, Oklahoma, watching Free Speech TV. Hey, George, you wanted to respond to Billy from yesterday, who said there was no racism in the white community, or words to that effect?
Yeah, Billy from yesterday, has a double meaning. Anyway, I live in LaFleur County, Oklahoma.
Mm-hmm.
That's down in the southeastern corner across from Fort Smith, Arkansas. This county has always been known as Little Dixie. And I just, there's lots of stars and bars flowing around here.
Oh, so you're responding. I had said in many ways we're still fighting the Civil War, and I'm starting to refer to Fox as the official voice of the CSA, the Confederate States of America. So that's what you're responding to, what Billy said, there's no such thing.
That's right.
Yeah, okay.
Well, I've noticed that I think the argument was that you made some remarks that they would just as soon refight the Civil War. And I've noticed that wherever the stars and bars are flown around here, that you will also find great arsenals within the house.
Yeah.
And on top of that, you will find low education and people well-versed in the Old Testament.
Yeah. Yeah. This is the way that the Republican Party has chosen to reach out to their suckers. And they're doing tremendous damage to these poor people. I mean, they're just tremendous damage. Think of how many children have died accidentally by picking up dad's guns in households that have been suckered into believing the Republican ideology, for example. George, thank you for sharing that. Remarkable. Welcome to Oklahoma, huh? We'll be right back. Hey, just a reminder, if you happen to be in the D.C. Maryland area tonight, Senator Bernie Sanders is going to be holding a discussion on the budget I'm quite sure NBC, CBS, ABC will not cover it, but you can be there. It's at the International Brotherhood of Electrical Workers Hall, 4371 Parliament Place in Lanham, Maryland, 6:30 tonight. It's free for all, but please RSVP. They need to get some sense of how many people are going to show up. Please RSVP through Senator Sanders' Facebook page. So, anyway. Linda in Deerfield Beach, Florida. Hey, Linda, what's on your mind?
Hi, Tom. Thank you for taking my call and all your hard work, you and your whole family and crew. We love you.
Thank you.
We letter carriers, we're always on ears when you are speaking. And I know myself I'll be voting for Bernie because he has just been on the forefront of helping us out with our situation with him trying to privatize the post office.
Yes.
And he's truly just a great, great person. I don't even have words for him. He's just great.
Yep.
But my husband wanted me to call you and let you know. He said, just tell people, he says, if you can get it there, you know, on Tom. He said, this is how the Republicans are. This is how they're flaunting their riches. The Kentucky Derby is watched by almost everybody. You don't have to be a millionaire. You can just watch it. It's free.
Right. It's on TV.
You know, and these people put it's on the TV, right? And, you know, it's a billionaire's game is what it is because these horses cost millions. But if you look at the horse that was number 15, his name was called Far Right. That was just basically throwing it in the middle class's face. See, I have money and my horse is worth millions. He named that horse Far Right.
Wow.
That just drove me crazy.
Wow.
You know, you can look it up on the internet.
I believe you.
The Republican arrogance. They don't care anymore about us. They're not going to care until we lose this country.
Yeah, to a certain extent, they're not even pretending anymore to care about the average working person. I mean, look at what Scott Walker, he just came out and said that if he becomes president, he's going to take his right to work for less law that he imposed on the people in Wisconsin, which has already destroyed union membership at the public sector. It's down to 20,000 from over 60,000 just in the last year. He's going to do that nationally, destroy the union movement, because the union movement historically has been, you know, supporters of the Democratic Party because unions are democracies and the Democratic Party has historically been with the workers. They don't care. They don't care. They are so arrogant. Scott Walker in particular is so arrogant in his belief that the Koch brothers will just throw another 20 million, 50 million, 100 million bucks at him, as they did to help him, you know, with the recall, as they did to help him, you know, with all the troubles that he's been in. It's awesome. It's astonishing. Linda, thank you for the call. That's a fascinating little factoid. Lori in Bellevue, Florida. Hey, Lori, what's up?
Hey, Tom. That's pretty funny about Scott Walker. I remember in his last re-election, if you will, he was just a little sidebar. His big thing was, I think it was for women's reproductive rights. Oh, we're not going to talk about that right now. Which didn't mean that he wasn't going to sign off on it the second he got in, which he did.
Right.
It was just, oh, we're not going to talk about that. Anyway, talk about taking control of the program. Democrats need to use this opportunity to demand what the candidates stand for. We need to take control of the argument and filibuster distractions. So when we go on any program, we need to bring a little chart that shows exactly what we stand for. And if we all have the same several good things, education and healthcare and all the good things that Democrats stand for there all the time, maybe we can inadvertently or directly educate people. Because in Florida, people down here really don't have a clue. I came from Massachusetts, and down here, they're against people because of their color. Ooh, that president's yucky. They're against people because of their religion or because they want to, you know, get free health care. And, you know, somebody's got to pay for it. Why should I have to pay for them? They buy into it because they can't afford anything but Fox on the national news. And that's what they hear. So they don't have an alternative.
Yeah.
They don't know what the real world offers.
Yep, I agree. You know, Roger Ailes and Rupert Murdoch were very, very slick, very smart guys when they said, we will forego the revenue opportunity that MSNBC takes by making MSNBC a premium channel. It costs you an extra $5 a month, or at least that's the cost here in D.C. It's probably different in various states. we're going to not make Fox a premium channel. We're going to make a basic cable, and you know, we'll make less money, but we'll reach a lot more people. And because they understood, and this is what I think the management at NBC, this is where I think that they're failing, frankly, with their television network, with MSNBC, is that Fox, I shouldn't say failing in a vacuum, failing relative to Fox, is that Fox is run as a mission. You know, Roger Ailes is a missionary. He was a partisan and an activist in the Nixon White House. He has been a political partisan and activist his entire life. Same is true of Rupert Murdoch. And they were willing to lose $500 million. They lost $500 million. They lost $100 million a year for the first 5 years. Now it declined with each year, but the first 5 years they were losing money with Fox News, and they didn't care. It was just a matter of getting audience. And you know, MSNBC is not on a mission. They're owned by Comcast and GE and who God only knows who all, and they have to answer to their shareholders, and their shareholders are saying, we want profits, so give us ratings, and whatever produces the ratings we'll take. And there's not an ideological management, there's a business management, and it's
unfair and not balanced.
Yeah, no, it's really unfortunate. I look at both of these. Now, where I look at the media landscape in America, and I'm very saddened by it, frankly.
About Hillary Clinton's popularity, whether or not she was trustworthy or not,
right.
Ask that question of no other candidates. You cannot pick and choose what questions that are universal.
You're right.
Just for the Democratic candidate.
I agree. And Hillary Clinton is not her husband. And frankly, you look at her political history and even before she was in politics, and I think that she's far more progressive than her husband was. But I am the eternal optimist. I might be in la-la land. Who knows? Anyhow, Lori, thank you for the call. We'll be back. It's 28 minutes past the hour.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Call 202-536-2370.
Stick around. Back with your calls right after this. 28 minutes past the hour. I just looked up at the clock and holy cow, the show's almost over. It's like we got a half hour left. I feel like we just got started. Amazing. Amazing. Time flies when you're having fun, right? Okay. Russell in Hickory Hills, Illinois. You wanted to talk about this whole, both Ted Cruz and Rand Paul have weighed in on the, they're going to investigate the possibility that the U.S. government is going to try and take over Texas and take all the guns from all the good gun-toting Confederate soldiers down there or something?
Well, what I heard was that Abbott's put the National Guard down there to watch because we're on maneuvers about shackling the Republicans, putting them on a boxcar and housing them in some Walmart.
Why? Yeah, there's 5 closed Walmarts in Texas, and one of the conspiracy theories is that underneath those Walmarts there are underground prison cells, basically. And that this military exercise by the federal government, they're probably not going to do it. They're just trying to figure out how to do it. You know, is it practical to basically take over Texas and then go house to house and take anybody who has guns and put them in one of these prisons at one of these 5 empty Walmarts? This is the theory that I've been reading, that I've seen on some of the right-wing websites. And it's really ubiquitous. I mean, the thing is all over the right wing. And this is why both Ted Cruz and Rand Paul have had to come out and say, I'll look into it. You know, I don't think there's anything there, but I'll look into it. And why Greg Abbott is, you know, the governor of Texas is like, hey, we're going to keep an eye on these guys. It's bizarre. Oh, you've got Cruz. Oh, here's Shano's got the audio of Ted Cruz. Here he is.
Now, my office, we've reached out to the Pentagon to inquire about this exercise. We're assured that it is a military training exercise. And I have no reason to doubt those assurances, but I understand the reason for concern and uncertainty, because when the federal government has not demonstrated itself to be trustworthy in this administration, the natural consequence is that many of the citizens don't trust what it's saying.
yeah, see, you got this black guy in the White House, and you just can't trust him, and therefore, you know, the federal government's coming down here to Texas. We got, well, whew. Russell,
why
back to you.
Why waste our time with him? Why
say
waste
what?
Our time with Texas? It's going to fall Democratic within 10 years.
I think so. I think so. I think you're right. It might be even less than 10 years. The consequential election, of course, will be the one in the year that ends with zero, but, you know, when redistricting can happen. Interesting point. Russell, thank you for the call. Jeremy, in Lincoln, Nebraska, you wanted to talk about the Nordic model that Bernie referenced on Stephanopoulos' show, Democratic Socialism?
Yeah, it was because one of the main arguments I hear against social benefits and social safety nets is that they're infeasible or that they would somehow weaken the economy. But aren't those Scandinavian countries that employ social democracy incredibly strong counterarguments to that?
Yes, they are. The problem is that fewer than 5% of Americans have passports. In fact, I think it's fewer than 3%, and fewer than 1 or 2%. The numbers may have gone up since the last time I looked at it, which was probably 6-8 years ago, have ever traveled overseas, you know, outside of Mexico and Canada. And so most Americans, and I'd be astonished if 1% of Americans have ever visited any Scandinavian country whatsoever. So most Americans have no idea. You say Holland, they think wooden shoes. You say Germany, they think World War II. You say Sweden and they think blondes. They don't have an idea. They don't have a clue.
Yeah, I guess that explains it.
So it's hard. It's really hard to say to the American people, you know, we should do what Denmark does, when the American people don't know. You know, they've never been to Denmark. They have no idea. They're clueless, and which again is another big failing in our media, because educating people doesn't always get the profits, the high ratings, and doesn't make the oil industry and everybody happy so that they'll buy more ads on your network. The way that infotainment does, you know, if it bleeds, it leads. Hey, let's talk about the latest, you know, whack-a-mole shooter, whatever it may be. So, anyhow, Jeremy, thank you for the call. Maine in Chicago. Hey, Maine, what's up?
Hey, how you doing?
Good.
Tom, yeah, I just wanted to say about Bernie Sanders, you know, having his fingers on the pulse of the people, and that even if he may not get the nomination, you know, I believe he can push Hillary definitely more left. But I believe, you know, she could get hit twice because, Obama beat her and Bernie Sanders. With him talking the way he's talking, the truth is hard. Excuse me. When the truth hits you like he's telling it, you know, I think it'll wake a lot of people up, and I think, you know, it could turn into a movement.
Yep, I sure hope so, and I see it happening. I mean, it actually is turning into a movement, and this is the biggest challenge that at BernieSanders.com, this is the biggest challenge that his campaign has right now, is they say it's going to be May 26th before they've got, you know, which is, what, another 15 days? No, it's another 11 days until... No, am I doing my math right? 20 days, whatever it is. It's going to be May 26th before they have the website built out to the point where they can accommodate volunteers and start setting up offices all around the country and that kind of thing. And so, you know, go over and sign up and get ready. But, you know, there's a lot of work to do. But it is a movement, and it has, I think it's frankly overwhelmed, Bernie's people. I don't think that they were expecting this strong a response. Bernie said, don't underestimate me. He was spot on right. Maine, thanks a lot for the call. Great to hear from you. Tom in Albany, Oregon. It says that you are a conservative who disagrees with me about something. What's up?
Yeah, there's about 98-99% that I disagree with you about. First-time caller, first-time listener, actually. So I was just listening to your comments about MSNBC and how it's money-driven and not political. How the few times that I've actually watched MSNBC, there was nothing but political.
You talking about Morning Joe, the conservative show in the morning?
No, I'm talking just...
That's their number one show.
Afternoon.
No, that's their number one show is Morning Joe. See, MSNBC is owned by a for-profit corporation. Rupert Murdoch owns Fox, and he has the choice of, am I going to make money or not make money? And with Fox, they chose not to make money for the first 5 years, and he brought in Roger Ailes, who's an ideologue, to run the network. There's not an ideologue, to the best of my knowledge, running MSNBC. I might be wrong. Maybe Phil Griffin is a flaming liberal, but he's not doing the daily memos from Bill Salmon or the kind of stuff from Roger Ailes that you see over at Fox. It's just not happening. That's not a hit on the network. Tom, thanks for the call. I watch MSNBC. I'm very pleased that it's there. But, we have to look at our media with a clear eye. Let's put it that way. Now, Ivan in Chicago. Hey, Ivan, you want to talk about a religion?
Yeah, Tom. excuse me. The founders were acutely aware of religion when they wrote the Constitution.
Oh, boy, were they.
Why? In the Constitution, you will not see the word God, Jesus, Christianity, the Bible, the Ten Commandments.
Right.
It's not in there.
Yeah.
And then, like we all know, Article 6, no religious test, the First Amendment, freedom to worship as you please. It's all there. And not only did the founders in Philadelphia sign that Constitution, it was ratified by every colony's legislature.
Yeah.
So they all agreed that there would be no national religion. Now, to all of the religious fundamentalists out there, Google Thomas Jefferson on religion. And it'll take you down the rabbit hole to where everybody, like Jefferson and Adams, despised the religious preacher. They respected the creator and the creation, but they considered popes, priests, and preachers as purveyors of superstitious nonsense.
You're absolutely right. And at some length they did. In fact, and Ivan, thank you for the call. Thomas Jefferson designed his own tombstone. He wrote his own epitaph for his tombstone. He had been president of the United States for 8 years. He designed his own tombstone in the 1820s. It was, a decade after he had left the White House. And on his tombstone, Thomas Jefferson wrote that he was the author of the Declaration of Independence, that he was the founder of the University of Virginia, the first free college in the United States. He was very proud of that. And that he was the author of the Virginia Statute for Religious Liberty. Now, here's what he said in his autobiography. These are Jefferson's own words. He said, where the preamble to the Virginia Statute of Religious Freedom, it was written by a bunch of legislators in Virginia when Jefferson was a legislator, declares that coercion is a departure from the plan of the holy author of our religion. In other words, forcing people to join a religion is wrong. An amendment was proposed by inserting the words Jesus Christ so that it should read a departure from the plan of Jesus Christ, the holy author of our religion. The insertion was rejected by a great majority in proof that they meant to comprehend within the mantle of its protection the Jew, the Gentile, the Christian, the Mohammedan, the Hindu, and the infidel of every denomination. Thomas Jefferson, his autobiography. This is also the guy who says, it does me no injury for my neighbor to say there are 20 gods or no God. It neither picks my pocket nor breaks my leg. 15 minutes before you.
You're listening to Tom Hartman. Visit TomHartman.com for audio and video archives.
Back with more of your calls right after this. Welcome back. Dave in Cleveland, Ohio. Hey, Dave, how you doing? Dave, you are on the air. Dave is not on the air. Okay. Let's try James in Spokane, Washington. Hey, James, what's on your mind?
Hey, Tom, neither picks your pocket or breaks your leg. I love that.
Yeah. Yeah.
Beautiful. Hey, as far as these bad actors that are on our public payroll, so to speak, don't we have criminal malfeasance charges in most jurisdictions?
Congress is exempted from a lot of that stuff. You know, in fact, in the Constitution, Congress is exempted from it. You cannot be accountable, held accountable for anything you say on the floor of the House or Senate if it's during, if it's when Congress is in session.
Yeah, but if they're acting misprehensive, if they're not doing their job, certainly a jury or their peers could possibly make that determination.
It's not a crime. It's not a crime not to do your job if you're a politician. It's our political system was set up so that the accountability of the politicians for things outside of normal laws. I mean, if they commit murder or rape or something like that, of course, they're going to get nailed. But with regard to political crimes, as it were, not doing their job or lying to people, the ultimate judge, jury, and executioner, as it were, you know, or those who, you know, fulfill the laws, are the voters. And so the idea was that politicians would be held to account at the ballot box, not in a court of law. Courts of law, by and large, have very little say over politicians outside of, you know, corruption and real crimes.
How about their appointees?
I don't know. It's going to depend on the state, and it's going to, and at the federal level, it's going to depend on you know, how they do at the federal level. If you know, like this, you've got this real problem right now with the Federal Election Commission: three Republicans, three Democrats, and the Republicans are blocking every single effort by the just the bureaucrats, the administrators, the staff of the Federal Election Commission, whose job it is to keep elections clean. They're trying to look into some of the dark money spending, some of the big money spending, some of the campaign funding, fundraising that's going on in both the Democratic and Republican parties, but in particular the Republican Party, because that's where the huge money is sloshing around. And the three Republicans on the Federal Election Commission are refusing to allow any of this to happen. In fact, they were supposed to have a breakfast last week. They refused to even agree on where to meet or what to eat for breakfast. That's how obstructionist these guys are. They are totally committed to turning this country over to the billionaires.
Isn't there a prosecutor, though, that could indict some of these people?
There's no law to indict them under.
Now, again, not congressmen or senators, but other people, other positions in more state and local governments. And, you know, there are prosecutors that should take up indictment charges against some of these guys.
Well, I think, you know, James, there are some places where I've argued that RICO statutes could come in, you know, racketeering influence and corrupt organizations. Although they were written fairly narrowly to mostly just go after the mob. And I believe that they may even specifically exclude politicians. But we need some sort of a RICO stand. You know, if you can demonstrate that there's an actual conspiracy, I mean, go back to the caucus room conspiracy, that there's an actual conspiracy to harm this country for political gain. I personally think that if not prosecuted, certainly. But see, here, this is the failure. The caucus room conspiracy happened January 20th, 2009. And I reported on it. I wrote about it. A number of people did in progressive blogs and things. The corporate media has not picked it up. Most people have no idea that these Republicans got together and swore that they were going to destroy the Obama presidency and the Obama legacy. It's terrible. James, thanks a lot for the call. We'll be back 10 minutes before the hour. Defending America from the Weapons of Mass Deception. Tom Hartman here with you and John in Gilbert, Arizona. Hey, John, thanks for listening to Sirius. What's on your mind?
Hey, Tom. Hey, I'm a little bit afraid because I think we're already leading into the same mistake we made in 2014 where our Democrat politicians did not support Obama and we lost everything. And what I'm referring to is everybody is talking about Hillary, and I think all of these talk shows, we all need to emphasize and talk about how wonderful and what Bernie Sanders stands for, because I'm so sick and tired of everybody talking about Hillary and everybody saying we need to push it to the left. You know what? I don't want to push anybody to who they're not. I want to elect somebody who is.
Yeah. Well, how did in 2014 – I didn't think that the Democrats lost because they failed to support the president. I felt that they lost because they failed to support core Democratic values. They were not speaking loudly and with great outrage about how Republicans want to privatize Social Security / you know, voucherize Medicare, how Republicans a year earlier cut off long-term unemployment benefits at the height of a recession, you know, on and on and on. I mean, those are the things that I think cost the Democrats the election in 2014, along with billions of dollars, hundreds of millions of dollars, no, probably billions of dollars from you know, the billionaire class on the other side running all kinds of negative advertising, you know, voter suppression advertising.
You know, Tom, I mean, somebody who has a pre-existing condition, I guess for me, it's the health care that really, you know, sticks with me. And I think, I don't think there's any support on that when there's so many people who now have health care because of the no more pre-existing condition.
Right.
And I think we failed to support our president on that.
Yeah. Yeah.
But anyways, I guess what I'm saying, you know, just from listening to like Stephanie and Michelangelo and everything, I mean, I just think we all need to have, we need to be a strong support team. And every single minute, whenever someone mentions Hillary, we need to talk about the difference and how wonderful Bernie is.
Well, let me, yes and no. I think we need to talk about the issues. And Bernie will say this. In fact, Bernie did say this last Friday. He said, this is not about me. It's not about whether Bernie Sanders wants to be president. It's about whether America wants this set of issues to be put into place. And he lays them out very clearly. He says, this is where I stand. This is what I support. This is what I oppose. There's no ambiguity there. And frankly, I think that what he has done is he has established a bar for other Democrats, and not just running for president, not just Hillary Clinton, but for Democrats running for the Senate, for Democrats running for the House, for Democrats running in state races, for Democrats running for governor, for Democrats running for dog catcher. I think Bernie Sanders has established a new standard for the necessary political dialogue in the Democratic Party. And for that, I am eternally grateful. I think it's the most important thing he's done. And if he becomes president on top of it, I will be such a happy camper. You know, it's unbelievable. But I don't think that we should be using Bernie to try to take down Hillary. Hillary may end up our nominee, and if she is our nominee, we need to do everything we can to make sure that she gets elected. You're going to have four members of the Supreme Court over 80 years old coming up in another couple of years, and that is, you know, the Supreme Court has taken more power than the legislative branch or the executive branch. They stole that power. They didn't do it legally, in my opinion, but they have it, and the president gets to appoint the Supreme Court, so... You know, we need to take the Senate back because the Supreme Court nominees are ratified by the Senate. And there's a good chance we can take the Senate back. Democrats can take the Senate back because there's about twice as many. It's about 2-1, the number of Republicans who are running for reelection versus the number of Democrats who are running for reelection in 2016 in the U.S. Senate. So, you know, John, I think, you know, the difference between our positions is very slight and very nuanced. Broadly speaking, I agree with you. Thank you for the call. An excellent point. Neil in Dayville, Connecticut. Hey, Neil, Reagan didn't invent Reaganism.
That's right. A.W. Mellon did, and he was Secretary of the Treasury in the 20s.
Right.
He had been trying to sell this idea that rich people create jobs, which was a stark contrast or a stark departure from everything most economists had been saying. And he finally got the ear of the Republicans. And basically he said that rich create jobs by cutting taxes on the rich. Those jobs will be created, that taxing the rich is punishing America's success, so on and so forth.
You're absolutely right.
He created a pamphlet, which he circulated amongst the rich. The average people never saw it, so he could lay the groundwork for this. He even created a chart in that pamphlet that showed how many middle-class jobs would be created. So in the 20s, they rewrote the tax code. We socially engineered money to the rich people. The jobs, which they dumped into the stock market, the jobs never showed up.
Right.
And that's because rich people randomly throwing money into the stock market does not create jobs. Demand does, which is what economics tells us. Two-thirds of economic expansion and stability comes from consumption. And
right.
That's always mainstream. No matter how much money you give the richest one-tenth of 1%, they can't consume enough goods to sustain an economy.
Yeah, you know, you're absolutely right. And in fact, it was Andrew Mellon who in 1929, when the crash happened, said, liquidate everything. Liquidate labor, liquidate industry. In other words, he was like, don't do anything. Let the bottom fall out. And, of course, being a billionaire himself in today's dollars, Andrew Mellon was thinking, and then I can sweep in and buy everything for pennies on the dollars, which is exactly what happened. The biggest fortunes, some of the biggest fortunes in America were either made or wildly amplified during the Great Depression because they could buy all kinds of stuff at pennies on the dollar. And so, yeah, Reaganism really, you could call it Mellonism, you could call it Hardingism, Coolidgeism. In fact, back in the day of Franklin Roosevelt, they used to refer to it as Hooverism, because, you know, Herbert Hoover was the president when the crash finally happened. So Hooverism and Reaganism, pretty much the same thing. And you're absolutely right. I don't know about the pamphlet with Alan, Andrew Mellon. But good point, Neil. Thank you very much. See, there's nothing new under the sun, right? It's like, you know, what goes around comes around and all this kind of stuff. No, there's nothing new under the sun. We'll be back tomorrow. Thanks for being with us today. It's a fascinating and ever-changing political landscape out there, the landscape that actually does affect your life and your kids' lives and your parents' lives and your friends' lives. This requires political action. Tag, you're it. We'll see you tomorrow.
You've been listening to Tom Hartman. For audio and video archives, visit TomHartman.com.
Hey friends, Tom Hartman here. Thanks so much for watching and listening to the program. The Tom Hartman program is brought to you in part by the following underwriters. Identity Guard. Count on us to help protect what makes you, you. WIX.com. Everyone deserves to have their own website. ITMTrading.com. America's source for rare coins and precious metals. BostonBeer.com. Boston Beer, maker of handcrafted beers. Geico.com. Providers of insurance. IdentityGuard.com. Total protection. Quicken Loans. Engineered to amaze. And EcoWine.com. Your source for organic wine since 1980. These underwriters support our show, so please help by supporting the people who make this program possible. You can learn more at TomHartman.com.